The headlines: the Yemeni army says it has successfully targeted Abha Airport in southwestern Saudi Arabia. Iran's President Raisi says the Biden administration's policies do not differ from those of the Trump administration. And Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Western threats and ultimatums would do nothing to ease tensions over Ukraine. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Yemeni army says it has successfully targeted Abha Airport in Saudi Arabia's southwestern region of Asir. The army spokesman Yahya Sari says that the Qassem K2 drones were used in the operation, which has reportedly disrupted flights at the airport. Sari noted that the Saudi-led coalition has been using the airport for launching airstrikes against Yemen. The coalition's warplanes have bombed different regions across Yemen, including the capital Sana'a, over the past day. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a war against the kingdom's southern neighbor in 2015 with the aim of reinstating a friendly regime there. The U.S. has been assisting the coalition with munitions and intelligence support. The war has brought about a severe humanitarian crisis in Yemen, pushing millions of people on the verge of starvation. Just hours ago, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi met with dozens of foreign ambassadors in Tehran on the occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. During his speech at the event, the president drew an analogy between the current and the former U.S. administrations. He said the Biden administration is no different from his predecessor in his policies and actions. The president also talked about Iran's 2015 deal, saying the status quo is the result of Washington's withdrawal and the inaction of other signatories. President Raisi said diplomacy only works when all sides abide by their commitments, and pointing out to the ongoing Vienna talks, he said that any negotiations should guarantee Iran's national interests.
Talks are resumed in Vienna to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. This is the eighth round of such talks in the Austrian capital. The U.S. has so far failed to remove its maximum pressure sanctions, which it imposed on Iran after the former pulled out of the JCPOA, and give guarantees that a future administration will not ditch the deal again. Now Iran's top security chief said that there is no coherence coming from the U.S. on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. Ali Shamkhani has stressed that the U.S. administration cannot impose the cost of its internal disputes on Iran.
And I think that now what we are witnessing is a division internally in the United States in the political establishment, both Democrats and Republicans, regarding a resolution to the ongoing situation with Iran regarding whether to go back to the table and to rejoin the JCPOA. We know that Biden has made overtures, and the State Department has said that they would grant some concessions in the forms of sanctions waivers. But like many Iranian commentators and politicians and diplomats have said, it doesn't go far enough.
Voices from the U.S. government show that there is no coherence in the country to make political decisions in the direction of advancements in the Vienna talks. The U.S. administration cannot pay for its internal disputes by violating Iran's legal rights. And voice from Iran and the P4 plus 1 group of countries, Britain, France, Russia, and China plus Germany, have been holding negotiations in the Austrian capital for 10 months in a bid to resurrect the JCPOA.
And I think that there's not much appetite for a deal with Iran at this point. I think the Trump administration did tremendous damage to the JCPOA by removing itself from it.
The Vienna revival talks are now focused on the guarantees that Iran is looking for, which include the verification of any sanctions and removal measures. Iran also wants to be assured that sanctions will not be brought back under new names or pretexts. But most importantly, it is seeking assurances that the next U.S. administration will adhere to the deal, something which the U.S. Special Envoy Rob Malley has said that Washington cannot guarantee, and hence bringing the fate of the deal into question.
The new round of talks comes amid rising hawkish voices in the U.S. A group of 33 U.S. Republican senators, led by Senator Ted Cruz, wrote a letter to President Biden warning him that any deal with Iran on restoring the JCPOA requires Senate approval. The senators warned Biden that they will do everything in their power to block a possible deal if he moves forward without them. They also said that the implementation of any agreement will be severely if not terminally, hampered. If the Biden administration does not fulfill a range of obligations in relation to congressional oversight over any agreements. The Republican senators said that if there is a deal that does not have Senate approval, it would be subject to being reversed as soon as there is a new president.
We see that the United States has been belligerent and has continued to put what it calls a maximum pressure campaign on the Iranian people, on the Iranian state, on the legal and legitimate Iranian government. And we see it as a web of coordinated activities by which we also know that Israel and the Zionist lobby are also pushing very heavily in the United States, in Washington.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally left the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to the nuclear case as part of his maximum pressure campaign. The pressure campaign was led by the Israeli and Arab lobby groups in the U.S. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it is willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage.
So I think that the internal divisions in the United States politically will continue to give free rein to the national security state in the United States to continue to put maximum pressure on Iran. But we know very well that Iran is a sovereign country and it will defend itself.
Iranian officials have repeatedly stressed that the onus falls on the U.S. to remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic in a verifiable manner and guarantee that a new U.S. administration would not breach the JCPOA again.
Our correspondent Homolesky joined us earlier from Vienna with more details on the resumption 8th round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the 2015 deal.
So this morning there was yet another meeting between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Baghdadi, and EU coordinator Enrique Mora. And right now we just got the news that Mr. Baghdadi is in a bilateral meeting with his Russian counterpart, Mikhail Ulyanov, taking place right now. And of course, these meetings have been going on since the 8th round resumed on Tuesday between Iran and the remaining signatories of the JCPOA. Of course, we know that the U.S. team led by Special Representative Rob Malley is also here, indirectly involved in the talks. The Russian ambassador tweeted saying that he's been talking with Mr. Malley as well on finding ways to keep things moving. And just yesterday, as we said, Mr. Ulyanov said that in his meeting with the EU coordinator, they'd tried to find, in his words, creative means or ways to resolve the outstanding remaining issues. What are they? What we're hearing is, and the most important issue is guarantees. And this is what some have been calling, some experts have been calling, inherent guarantees of any kind of agreement. If we look at any agreement that's being signed between various parties, what guarantees are going to be in it that will make it costly for any of the sides to violate it, to withdraw from it, as happened under the Trump administration? Why Iran is insisting on these guarantees, of course, because of its past experience.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released a new video of a long-range ballistic missile unveiled on Wednesday. The missile, dubbed Kheba Shekan, is capable of hitting targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint accuracy. It can also penetrate missile shields with high maneuverability. The projectile is classified as the third generation of long-range missiles developed by the IRGC. In recent years, Iran has made great advances in its missile program, which it says is entirely defensive. The latest missile test comes as the country marks the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Israeli settlers stormed Islamic holy sites at a Palestinian village in the northwest of the occupied West Bank. Settlers under army protection broke into four Palestinian shrines in Kfar Haris and vandalized a number of vehicles. Israeli settlers regularly attack Palestinian homes, shops, and holy shrines in the occupied West Bank with impunity. Human rights groups accuse Israel of using settler violence to force Palestinians to leave their homes as part of its land grab policy. Some 700,000 Israeli settlers live in the occupied West Bank. Under international law, all Israeli settlements in the occupied territories are deemed illegal. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Western threats and ultimatums would do nothing to ease tensions over Ukraine. In a meeting with his British counterpart in Moscow, Lavrov said that Moscow is in favor of diplomacy. He also downplayed the Western anxieties over Russian military drills in Belarus. In the meantime, NATO has issued a statement saying that if Russia chooses non-diplomatic approaches, it would face economic sanctions and an increasing military presence by the alliance in Eastern Europe. These exchanges follow simultaneous 10-day military drills by Ukraine and Russia. Ukraine says Russia's joint drills with Belarus are meant for psychological pressure and that Washington is calling them an escalatory action. The West has been alleging for some time that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine, but the Kremlin denies this, saying instead that NATO should stop its eastward enlargement.
In recent days, a series of separate delegations from the EU have traveled to the United States, Ukraine, and Russia as tensions between the West and Moscow show no sign of abating. The Kremlin insists the security of Russian citizens is paramount, and therefore Ukraine cannot be allowed to join NATO. On Monday, the head of the 30-nation alliance confirmed additional NATO forces have been moved to Eastern Europe, and there's a plan to make that permanent.
There is a process now going on within NATO, also, of course, in close consultation with our military commanders, to adjust our presence in the eastern part of the alliance.
Peace activists claim NATO is being unnecessarily provocative.
We would have a lot of advantages only with one symbolical sentence, not to expand with Ukraine and Georgia. And then Putin would be satisfied and you can make agreements with him.
The EU is sending huge amounts of money to Kiev.
More than 17 billion euros.
Even though the bloc's own agencies say Ukraine is corrupt at the highest levels, EU citizens are worried the situation could exacerbate the bloc's energy crisis, given that we import so much from Russia.
Putting in danger European gas supplies. So this is really frightening to me personally. And I think the whole European population should be frightened about this.
That could be a solution for the energy crisis. Everybody just spend less money on army and more money on compensation, kind of energy support for the people.
A number of political commentators say some senior figures in the EU and NATO believe the West is pushing Russia a bit too far. Double standards and hypocrisy are at play, according to impartial foreign policy analysts.
They remind us the United States has approximately 800 military bases in 80 nations around the world. This as Russia is vilified for moving troops within its own borders. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The European Commission says the Eurozone's economy will grow less than expected in 2022 as surging inflation hampers recovery from the COVID pandemic. The EU executive says the bloc's gross domestic product will grow by 4% this year instead of the 4.3% forecast of only 3 months ago. Inflation is also set to increase to a much higher level than previously expected. The bloc experienced an economic boom in much of 2021 as the pandemic's toll started to wear off. The EU's economy commissioner says the growth has been hampered due to staff shortages, supply chain issues, and soaring energy prices. Further rise in inflation is also feared as a possible conflict between Moscow and the West over Ukraine could slash energy supply from Russia to Europe. Russia provides more than 40% of the bloc's natural gas. Iran's Islamic Revolution is being recalled globally by those who were of age to witness its immediate impact and for others who continue to feel its international legacy. Mina Taylor has more from London.
The revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the US-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gelli, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally.
For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also accepted colonialism an occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa, around the world, who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution.
The Iranian revolution, as I mentioned, it tells us how you don't have to have only one model of political system, whereby, I mean, here in this country, we have a monarch who is head of a national church, but it's a farce. In reality, God has been pushed out of a public sphere, and so the whole thing is a charade. In Iran, there is a valuable presence of faith in the public sphere.
As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, you know, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here. And they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth. They're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Hearty congratulations to all our listeners on the 43rd 10-day dawn celebrations marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
In the limelight.
In the United States, a Texas man is set to go on trial this month, and prosecutors have released a detailed list of their witnesses and evidence, including testimony from the defendant's two teenage children. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Alan Feuer. The piece is titled Government Reveals Trove of Evidence in First January 6th Trial. In Washington, prosecutors have provided a revealing glimpse of their strategy for the first trial stemming from the attack on the Capitol, unveiling an inventory of the extensive evidence they intend to introduce, including surveillance videos, police communications, text messages, geolocation data, and testimony from a Secret Service agent, and the defendant's own children. The defendant in the trial, set to begin on 28th of February, is Guy Wesley Reffitt, An oil industry worker who prosecutors say was a member of the Texas Three Percenters, a far-right group connected to the gun rights movement. Guy Wesley Reffitt stands accused of storming the Capitol with a pistol at his waist. The charges against him include interfering with law enforcement officers during a civil disorder and obstructing Congress's duty to certify the results of the 2020 presidential election. The trial, the earliest of several related to the events of 6th of January 2021 scheduled this year, will mark a major turning point in the Justice Department's vast investigation of the Capitol attack. About 200 people have pleaded guilty so far to charges connected to the violent assault that disrupted the peaceful transfer of power. Of those, nearly 90 have already been sentenced. The Reffitt trial, which will take place in Federal District Court in Washington, is expected to be the first time that prosecutors will publicly offer evidence of the allegations they have made against scores of other similar defendants. Under what is sure to be enormous scrutiny, the prosecutors will have to demonstrate the law enforcement officers were adversely affected by the riot and that Mr. Reffitt was part of a pro-Trump mob that illegally stopped the work of Congress. To that end, the prosecutors have amassed an expansive array of witnesses and evidence, according to the list they filed on Monday night, 7th of February. While much of the information they planned to introduce had been revealed in previous court papers and court hearings, some of it was new, suggesting that they may have similar undisclosed evidence waiting in the wings for future trials. Mr. Reffitt's lawyer, William L. Welsh, did not respond to a request for comment on the government's evidence, but his client has openly pushed back against accusations that he took part in anything untoward at the Capitol on 6th of January 2021. In a letter obtained by ProPublica last spring, Mr. Reffitt wrote of the attack, "There was no insurrection, no conspiracy, no sinister plan, and no reason to think otherwise." While Mr. Reffitt's trial is certain to attract attention for being the first, other larger and more complicated trials are tentatively scheduled for later in the year. Four leaders of the far-right nationalist group, the Proud Boys, are set to go on trial in Washington in May. And in July, prosecutors plan to try 11 members of the Oath Keepers militia, including its leader Stuart Rhodes, on charges of seditious conspiracy. The Reffitt trial is likely to begin with an overview of the tumult on 6th of January offered by a police officer who worked that day at the U.S. Capitol Police Command Center, overseeing a video surveillance system and radio and phone communications, prosecutors said. The officer will explain the progression of the riot through a compilation of surveillance videos from both inside and outside of the building, and will show the jury a separate video of former Vice President Mike Pence's motorcade leaving the East Plaza of the Capitol at 1:57 p.m. Three other Capitol police officers are scheduled to testify about their direct interactions with Mr. Reffitt and other members of the mob, prosecutors said. These police officers are expected to describe their experiences trying to control the crowd by firing pepper balls and other projectiles and to give accounts of failing to subdue Mr. Reffitt and his fellow rioters with chemical spray. Much of the government's evidence came from search warrants executed on Mr. Reffitt's property. Prosecutors say, for instance, that they have geolocation data from an app on Mr. Reffitt's iPhone that pinpoints his precise movements before, during, and after the Capitol attack. They also say they have extracted from the phone several threads of messages he sent and received by text and via the chatting app Telegram. Prosecutors are in possession of a 31-minute video that Mr. Refit apparently took during the riot with a panoramic camera. They also say they have another video, nearly 2 hours in length, entitled Texas State Meeting Zoom, which may be an online event hosted by the Texas 3%ers that Mr. Refit attended. Among the other witnesses set to testify at the trial are a Secret Service agent and a former counsel to the Secretary of the Senate. The agent intends to describe emergency actions taken on 6th of January 2021 to protect Mike Pence and to show the jury a video of the former vice president and others hurrying down a staircase after rioters breached the building. The Senate aide will explain the certification of the Electoral College vote that was disrupted by the riot, a central part of the prosecution's case that Mr. Refit and others obstructed the work of Congress. Prosecutors also revealed the existence of a new witness, a member of the Texas 3%ers who traveled with Mr. Refit to Washington. The witness, who is known for now only as R.H., was granted immunity against prosecution and will testify about the preparations the two made for their trip, including the firearms and the tactical gear that Mr. Refit brought with him, prosecutors say. Perhaps the most emotional witnesses to testify at the trial will be Mr. Refit's teenage son and teenage daughter. Prosecutors say the son, who was 18 years old at the time of the attack, will tell the jury that he and his sister, then 16 years old, spoke with their father when he returned from Washington after the riot and that Mr. Refit threatened to shoot them if they went to the FBI about him. In a previous court hearing, the daughter testified that Mr. Refit threatened to put a bullet in her cell phone if she posted about him on social media.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
These days mark the anniversary of the victory of Islam after an era of darkness covering the entirety of the earth. These days are the days that the light of the Ahlul Bayt, the light of the Imam of our time, started to shine on the earth again. Through the revolution of the Ahlul Bayt, the Islamic revolution. How did the revolution happen? The revolution did not happen because there were armed groups fighting the regime. That was not what brought the regime to its knees, the regime of the Shah to its knees. That didn't. Read the history of the revolution. Imam Khomeini did not tell some of those groups that were really believers and they were mujahideen who were fighting the system and they were taking out some major figures from the Shah's regime. They had supplied themselves and trained themselves with arms, and they took out certain figures. Imam Khomeini didn't tell them what you're doing is haram. But Imam Khomeini didn't encourage that. That's not what he did. I'm not going to, you guys do whatever you think is right. That's your thing. But that wasn't what brought the regime to its knees. When Imam Khomeini started, he didn't say go out and kill the police or go out, put bombs here and there. He didn't do any of that. He addressed the Shah and he said, what you're doing is wrong, and people know that what is happening is wrong, and we should stand for Islam, stand for Allah. That's what he said. Okay. People came out next day on the streets in Qom and in Varamin, close to Tehran, a smaller town close to Tehran. People came out with their kafans. They were killed. Imam Khomeini was in prison. Imam Khomeini continued speaking, people coming out, some of them killed, some of them imprisoned. Imam Khomeini continued speaking. The numbers of supporters of this ideology, this belief in Iran started to grow. A year before the revolution, because of the work of the likes of Ayatollah Khamenei as a younger scholar in Mashhad, in other cities, there were a number of them, but one of the, or I should say, the prominent one, the most effective one after Imam Khomeini was Ayatollah Khamenei, that unfortunately, if we had time, I would explain all the details of why we insist on him being, from before the success of the revolution, being the prominent figure in the revolution, without getting his name out, without trying to show off that he... No. But it wasn't only him. There were others as well in different parts of the country, different cities. What was their work? Did they, again, supply arms? Did they say, go out and kill this, kill that, bomb here, bomb there? No. Hear what Imam Khomeini says. Support it. They came out in support. A year before the revolution succeeded, because of this work, when Imam Khomeini's son passed or he was assassinated, and they started holding big programs in Iran, the Shah had an article written to disrespect Imam Khomeini. The article was published. The people of Qom came out in large numbers against the Shah. That's all they did. Again, they didn't bomb anywhere. They didn't pull out arms. They didn't do that. They came out on the streets in large numbers against the Shah and against his command and against that cartoon and against that article that was published in that newspaper. The Shah came, cracked down on them, killed a number of them. News got out. The people of Tabriz and other cities, but the largest one was the people of Tabriz. 40 days later, on the Arba'in of the Shuhada, they learn from Imam al-Hussein's family, Arba'in, holding Arba'in of Shuhada. When you're in a movement against a tyranny, they held the Arba'in in Tabriz. People in Tabriz were killed. The Arba'in of the Shuhada of Tabriz was held in multiple cities. The largest congregations and the largest crackdown was in Yazd, another major city in Iran. Then it continued, and then day after day, it started picking up more and more momentum. In what way? Support of the people coming out. Imam Khomeini telling them, you need to come out and support and chant against the Shah. In Muharram, the Muharram programs, while Imam al-Hussein's name is mentioned, connecting it to that day, connecting it to their time, and connecting Yazid to their time. And so all those processions of Muharram were the largest processions against the Shah. And they killed them, but they continued coming. Again, bombing, guns, no. What support? Showing that support, coming out on the streets when it was needed to come out on the streets. When Imam Khomeini told them, we need to shut down industries in Iran, the workers shut down. When they supported, they didn't say we're going to come out in arms. Imam Khomeini said, the workers, the oil company workers, they shut down the oil company facilities, and so oil was not being exported. The car industry companies, the workers did not go to work. Other businesses, Some for 50 days. They shut down their business for 50 days, 2 months almost, until Imam Khomeini came and the revolution succeeded. Support in these ways. People need to join. In the early days, the numbers of people were small, and the Shah thought there's no threat here. Or when he felt the threat, exile. They tried to sentence Imam Khomeini to death. Again, the people supported, ulama supported. They couldn't do that. They sent him to exile. Thought they could get rid of that. Imam Khomeini continued. People started supporting more and more. The numbers of people started supporting. The level of support increased. And the revolution succeeded. The global revolution needs the same thing. The global revolution needs the exact same thing, the exact same pattern. If we do that, inshallah, by the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the same way that it took 15 years for those small groups in support of the Islamic Republic, in support of Imam Khomeini, in support of a revolution, on a level that they were willing to, just for coming out and speaking their support for Imam Khomeini, they came out with their kefans because they knew coming out means they're going to kill us. And they wanted to show that we are willing to come out and say we support even if you're going to kill us. We're ready for that. That's what wearing a kefan and coming out means. Small numbers in a couple or a few cities over time, because of their blood, because of their shuhada, the numbers increased, then this will happen on a global scale, brothers and sisters. We will have you, inshallah, and all of those that are like you, and there aren't too few either. We have made progress. There are many people from various ethnic backgrounds and even religious backgrounds that have realized this and are in support. Inshallah, and there are those who give life. They have given. The numbers will increase. The numbers will increase. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has promised. And it will come to a time where the Imam of our time will come. Meaning we will see him. He will reveal his identity. We'll all see him. And we see that as Dua Nudba we read, وَأَنْتَ تَأُمُّ الْمَلَأِ وَنَحْنُ نَقُولُ الْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. And you are تَأُمُّ الْمَلَأِ, you are leading the people, and we are around you, and we say Alhamdulillah رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. Do we see that that day comes? Inshallah, that day will come, and inshallah, it's near, and inshallah, we do. We're part of those that carry on this takleef.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Toxic pesticides banned for use in the United Kingdom are being exported to countries with less stringent regulations under loopholes in international trade rules. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Daniel Buffy and Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled EU Plans to Ban Use of Synthetic Pesticides in Parks. Toxic pesticides banned for UK are exported to other countries. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a leaked draft regulation, the use of synthetic pesticides in parks and other green public spaces in urban areas is to be banned in the European Union, with member states obliged to cut overall use by 50%. The move is said by the European Commission to be necessary owing to the failure of a number of EU member states to act on previous guidance on reducing the use of chemical pest control. Officials say in the draft regulation that as a result of the proposals, European Union consumers could see increasing food prices, which might lead to increased imports from third countries with less strict regulation of pesticide use. But officials have said they will examine ways to mitigate the impact, adding that the EU needs to shift to a fair, healthy and environmentally friendly food system. Under the regulation, pesticides would also be banned in nature protection areas. About 70 towns and cities in the United Kingdom are taking steps to reduce pesticide use, but there is not a prohibition in law. A spokesperson for the Pesticide Action Network UK, or PAN-UK, called on the British government to follow Brussels' lead. Pesticide Action Network UK has been calling for such a measure for many years and to see the European Commission bringing forward plans to end the unnecessary use of pesticides in urban areas is very welcome. It will be a huge benefit for the citizens and environment of the European Union. PAN UK would like to see the UK follow suit and end the use of pesticides in our towns and cities. The draft EU regulation, which will need to win the support of member states and the European Parliament, received a mixed reaction from environmental activists in mainland Europe. Concerns have been raised over the lack of strictures put on farmers to use methods such as crop rotation and mechanical weeding. Potential loopholes around the 50% target have also been identified, relating to a lack of confidence in the collection of accurate data. Sarah Weiner, a Green MEP, member of the European Parliament, said she feared the regulation would amount to empty promises. Sarah Weiner said the Commission's proposal on the sustainable use of pesticides in the European Union is anything but watertight. On the one hand, the Commission acknowledges that the old directive gives the member states too much leeway and consequently wants to turn it into a regulation. On the other hand, the Commission lists only insufficient measures to implement this basically good idea. Sarah Weiner added, "Not only that, but the Commission does not even want to make the basics of integrated pest management binding, which would be the absolute minimum to achieve lower pesticide use and protect human health and biodiversity." Furthermore, toxic pesticides banned for use in the United Kingdom are being exported to countries with less stringent regulations under loopholes in international trade rules. According to documents obtained by Greenpeace UK's Unearthed investigation and the Swiss non-governmental organisation Public Eye, in freedom of information requests, two companies, Syngenta and INEOS, are exporting from UK facilities large quantities of pesticides based on chemicals that would be illegal for use in the European Union. Export notification data for 2018 showed Syngenta planned to ship more than 28,000 tons of pesticide containing paraquat, which was banned for use in the United Kingdom in 2007. Paraquat, which is fatal at small doses if ingested, can damage the lungs, eyes, kidneys and heart through long-term exposure. Inovin, a subsidiary of the chemicals firm INEOS, made export notifications for 4,000 tons of the soil fumigant 1,3-dichloropropene, a suspected carcinogen banned in the European Union because of the risk it poses to wildlife and groundwater. The United Kingdom was responsible for about 40% of the exports of these and similar products from the European Union in 2018, the year to which the documents apply. While exporting these products is legal, despite the restrictions on their use in Europe, campaigners want the practice banned altogether because of the likely harm to the importing countries. Baskut Tunkak, who was from 2014 to 2020, was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the implications for human rights of the environmentally sound management and disposal of hazardous substances and waste, said, "The United Kingdom must urgently end the export of paraquat and 1,3-dichloropropene. These pesticides are among the worst of the worst, unquestionably hazardous to human health." In July, Buskat Tunkak and 35 experts from the Human Rights Council called for an end to such exports from rich nations to the developing world. France is enacting a ban, which came into force from 2022, but other countries have been reluctant to place constraints on their industries. Some of the pesticides are destined for developing countries, including Colombia, Ecuador, Mexico, India, and Indonesia. According to the data, large amounts are also sold to rich nations. The United States and Australia buy quantities of paraquat, and Japan takes paraquat as well as 1,3-dichloropropene. Tunkak said, "Just because a country is wealthy does not mean there are not grave human rights violations and abuses being committed against vulnerable communities." In the United States, where 3 times more pesticide products are registered for use, farm workers suffer more chemical-related injuries and illnesses than any other workforce. The racial dimension cannot be ignored, with so many agricultural and food workers from migrant and minority backgrounds. Doug Parr, chief scientist at Greenpeace UK, said selling the pesticides was exploitative hypocrisy and urged ministers to end the practice. Doug Parr said, "The United Kingdom is at the heart of a pesticide scandal that allows chemical giants to flood other countries, many of them poorer nations, with toxic chemicals on a major scale." Doug Parr added, "These pesticides are so dangerous that we've made the very sensible decision to ban their use in our own country and across Europe. But what gives us the right to think it is morally defensible to continue producing and shipping them around the world?" Other European nations are also exporting thousands of tons of pesticides that would be disqualified for use in Europe itself. In terms of European Union law, companies exporting certain substances must notify governments under a rule known as the Prior Informed Consent Regulation, overseen by the European Chemicals Agency, ECHA, which provides a list of exports. According to the agency's latest report, from last December, the United Kingdom, Belgium, Netherlands and Spain together exported 9,016 tons of 1,3-dichloropropene and the amount of paraquat and the herbicide trifluralin exported by the United Kingdom, Spain and Italy amounted to 15,983 tons. Greenpeace said its data differed from that published by the European Union because it came from export notifications, so it was not certain that the exact amounts intended to be sent abroad were exported, while the European Chemicals Agency ECHA data bundled together different chemicals for various purposes.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
Another point is that sometimes experts and specialists who are from among the people suggest ideas and solutions to the officials for different sectors. Officials should come up with a mechanism in order to be able to benefit better from these ideas. And this will actually help people to participate in the decisions of the responsible organizations of the country. This is one point. In addition, in order to benefit from the capabilities that are available in the people in practice, they should come up with another mechanism so that they can help the people participate in action as well. There are many individuals who are willing to help the administration in part of its work. They should make it clear how the people can become linked with a particular area in the administration. They should sit and think about this. This requires thinking, research, and other such things. Officials should also use the people's capabilities for supervision. There are cases of corruption and favoritism in some parts of the country. These may be hidden from the eyes of the authorities in charge, but the people see these. Therefore, they must use this capability of the people in this regard as well. Therefore, being from the people and being among the people are fundamental tasks. And government officials should pursue this in the way that has been briefly explained here. Overall, in return for the recommendations that we make to our dear people, the esteemed officials of the country should also consider themselves obliged to truly work with all their might.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, what I see today is that thankfully the esteemed officials from the top to the bottom are working and struggling hard. As far as I see, they are trying and going through much trouble. I hope their efforts will be blessed by God. They must continue these efforts, work for the people, and purify their intentions for God. In this case, their efforts will be a great act of worship. I ask God the Exalted to make the Iranian nation successful in all areas and fields, to help it defeat its enemies, to gladden the pure soul of our magnanimous Imam, to associate him with the friends of God, and to make him satisfied and pleased with us, so that we will not feel embarrassed before our magnanimous Imam. I hope that he will make the pure souls of the martyrs satisfied with us, to raise them with his friends, and to not make us ashamed before them. I once more send my greetings to the dear people of Qum and to you, honourable participants, in this meeting, and I hope that God will bestow his grace, mercy and blessings on all of you. May God's greetings, mercy and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.